This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Hi, it's after lunch. I know it's difficult to stay awake. I'll try to be my most entertaining and engaging and captivating, as my mother says I am. I want, first of all, to thank the organizers for the invitation. It's not often in the academic world that you find yourself in a situation in which you send a paper to a group of colleagues that embodies some very serious disagreement. And what you hear back from them immediately is an invitation to go address their annual gathering. As I don't expect I'm about to be beaten up, I suspect it's because the colleagues want to engage in debate, out of which hopefully, and I think I'm pretty sure we can emerge, with agreement at a higher level, analytical level, around policy goals that I think we very much share. So I approach you in this spirit. I need to say right away that this work came to a significant extent from an ongoing conversation with Professor Duncan Foley in New York City, but I take full responsibility for the outcome of this work. Having said all of that, I'll put the broad point that the paper motivates right away on the screen. This is the potentially controversial statement, that the paradox of costs, as it has been motivated in neo-Kaletskian contributions, also known as the wage-led growth, has no analytical purchase. Now, I'm still trying to figure out how to present papers which contain a high degree of mathematical formalism. And I'm coming to the conclusion, increasingly, the best thing you can do is say a few things that will hopefully spike the interest of one or two people to go read the bloody thing. And then we can try and talk about it. Because it's, I will present some of the formalization simply to reassure you that this is deliberate and has involved quite a bit of work of a comparative static basis, of a fully dynamic basis, and of comparative dynamic types as well. So the punchline, which is the main thing I want to share with you, coming from the conceptualization of the circuit of capital, is that wage flows and profit flows actually pertain to different moments of the process of social reproduction. Wages, of course, are paid as the decision to produce is undertaken, and profits are realized by sales that are funded by aggregate demand. So in the circuit of capital, whether you have a Marxian or Italian circuitist or a French circuitist to the circuit, you will realize that you're dealing with two different moments of reproduction. As a result, the functional distribution of income, or what I call the class distribution of income, will not only be determined by the real wage, or what we call the rate of exploitation in the Marxian framework, and the labor-capital ratio, which we call the composition of capital in the Marxian framework, but will also be shaped by the relative measure of productive and consumption undertakings at any point in time. So there is an additional determination of the aggregate or functional distribution of income that arises from deliberate consideration of the monetary circuit in capitalist reproduction. And that fundamentally changes a whole bunch of things. A seemingly innocuous accounting exercise actually unravels into a series of points that I would like to share with you. I say the paradox of cost has no purchase. I should be more careful. I was trying to put the disagreement right up front. It will have no purchase as it has been postulated in any setting in which there is meaningful autonomy between decisions to undertake production and decisions to consume. Which means a number of things in relation to the idea of wage-led growth. First of all, the functional distribution of income and output, or growth, if you go dynamic, are actually jointly determined variables, quantities, by decisions to produce and decisions to consume. Two variables, two quantities that are jointly determined by the same processes enjoy no causal relation. Their relationship is confounded and driven by changes in the underlying processes that are generating these two quantities. So that's the first point. The second point, which is broader, is that actually once you get down to it, you realize that the role of the consumption behavior of wage earners in conditioning or mediating the relationship between the real wage and output is actually fundamentally different than the mechanisms that one can deduce from the neo-Kaletskian framework that has supported the literature on wage-led growth. And that I will show you with some comparative static derivatives and so on, because it's worth chewing on a bit, because I think that everything hinges on that at the end of the day. These points are not evident in hitherto contributions for two reasons that come from the need to make simplifying assumptions when you're putting together a model. The first one is that in the neo-Keletzian models, wages and profits are always taken as a sharing of output. Output is divided into payments to wage and payments of profit. The second difficulty is that, certainly in what people call structuralism, the rejection of Say's law takes a very particular form, which is very useful for many applications. That form is that production commitments are taken to meet demand, and the adjustment is taken up by the rate of capacity utilization. This means two things. It means that you are assuming, when you're making these two assumptions, that all produced output is sold instantaneously. Yeah? And you're also then assuming or offering no account for the evolution of stocks of productive capacity and the evolution of inventories. Once you think of things, I mean, I'm assuming some colleagues here are familiar with the circuit disconceptualization. So the paper shows these points, making a number of exercises, comparative statics, some laying out of a fully dynamic model and showing that the determination of distribution that the paper identifies has purchase for transient or cyclical dynamics as well. And finally, engaging with the more difficult question of what is the purchase of these arguments for the trend exponential evolution underlying any given evolution. I'm loath to call that the long run for reasons similar as a discussion earlier, that the underlying trend is a logical category, not an empirically observable thing that you can define over 3 months, 5 years, 6 years. That's not the point. But this poses a more difficult question because presumably you can posit in the underlying exponential trend that outlay behavior is a function of certain stock flow ratios, and which would pin down this determinant of distribution, would not give it wiggle room. People can see this in the paper, but effectively, the question then becomes for the exponential trend significance of the point I'm making is that so long as any stock flow targets that may govern the outlay decisions of different sectors are not stationary, the points I'm making apply to what people would loosely call the long run, although with all of the disclaimers earlier about all of that. At the level of policy, and this is the last point before I do some math, what I'm trying to articulate, because it's not enough. I mean, you can be a bit of a jerk. You go up to a literature and say, oh, you guys are wrong. That's not useful. I mean, so I've been trying to think of what alternative conceptualizations can arise from this approach to distribution, and I've arrived at this idea that is half-baked because I mainly have defined it in opposition to something else. The idea is the idea of investment-led growth, and I mainly understand it as the antithesis of what you can broadly call the growth strategy or the industrial strategy, the macroeconomic strategy of the U.S. and Britain and Brazil in recent years, which is basically consumption-led growth. Growth in demand driven by increasing consumption propensities, driven by access to credit and asset price inflation. And what comes out of this analysis I'm pursuing is that that policy move, that increase in the relative weight of consumption in GDP, independently of any change in the wages, actually increases profit shares by doing a very particular quickening of what we Marxists call the turnover time of capital. So the answer is to do the opposite, but it poses some difficulties that I will hopefully have time in the end to at least pose to colleagues for discussion. And that's, I think, what I broadly just said. How much time have I got?
About 10 minutes.
I have 10 minutes left.
A little more than 10 minutes.
Okay. Is that counting the three? Mm-hmm. Quickly about the formalism, and I'll just do one little derivative, but it's the most important one. The notation I'm using comes from Duncan's framework, and it's just a bit cumbersome to introduce. It'll take me 2 minutes or so to do it, but it's worth it if people want to read the paper. Capital outlays are the expenditures by capitalist enterprises to initiate or to sustain production, and they can be roughly divided into labor and non-labor outlays. That separation or the relative quantity is called the composition of capital. You can call it a labor to output ratio if you want. It's the same thing, instrumentally. Call the total Z and call kappa the share of those outlays that pays wages. So that 1 minus kappa is buying non-wage, non-labor inputs. You can generalize this to include fixed capital or plain old non-labor inputs. Wages, of course, will be kappa z. And this is a markup pricing, a labor cost markup pricing framework. In fact, in a way, wholly analogous to structuralist Kaletskian approaches. And the idea is that you have a markup rate Q that is directly proportional to the composition, to the fraction of outlays accounted for by labor. And you have epsilon, the rate of exploitation, which can be understood as a real wage multiplier. And that gives you what the price to labor cost ratio will be. Tendentially. Then the aggregate demand, because this is demand-determined framework, the aggregate demand equation is relatively straightforward, just the notation is different from the conventional Kaletskian conceptualization, bear with me. On the right-hand side, you have the demand by enterprises for non-labor inputs, and then you have the demand for consumption goods by workers and capitalists, which I'll characterize in a little bit. Demand realizes sales that contain profits. The profits are the monetary realization of this markup rate Q. So R is, if you will, the mass of the flow of commodities currently being sold accounted for at cost. And 1 plus Q is the actual total revenue of the enterprise sector as those are sold. So that profits are QR. And the profit share, which is the measure of distribution I'm using throughout, is simply profit flows divided by wage flows, which leads us to the very quick simplification that I'll belabor in a second. All of this leads me to two equations around which everything hinges. The first one is what's happening in markets. I've taken the aggregate demand equation from before and added some very simple functional dependencies. I've put forward the bold hypothesis that sectoral spending flows are a function of their revenues. Very parsimonious, okay, because I'm trying to keep this light. The more complicated you make it, the harder it is to say meaningful things, especially when you go dynamic. And then I have these two shift parameters, lambda and vega, in the paper because I do an exercise where I consider credit allocated to production as a shift parameter that shifts capital outlays and consumption credit as a shift parameter that shifts the consumption of workers. But I'm just putting it there so that if people read it and find that I've introduced it. And then the other equation, of course, is the profit share, which is my measure of distribution. The first thing to note is that distribution there is not only conditioned by epsilon, or the real wage, and the labor output ratio, which is inside the R in there in some way, shape, or form, but it's also conditioned by this relationship I am pointing to, the relationship between capital outlays of enterprises and aggregate demand. If you think about it, you realize that that relationship is very much shaped by the consumption behavior of households. Because that's what introduces the wedge between the two. Our wage earner households and our capitalist households, what percentage of their income are they consuming? And what's interesting, and I actually came to this issue by thinking about contemporary financial behavior. Those of you who have with whom I've talked before know that that's where I come from in terms of field. Because actually financial behavior or financial developments have come to condition consumption behavior in a very significant way as capitalism has developed into what it is today. And to my mind has made this determination of distribution more and more significant. The broad intuition then about what this determination of distribution does is the following. Any evolution in which you have higher consumption rates in a comparative dynamic sense will be evolutions that have higher profit shares. And conversely, evolutions that have weaker consumption behavior will, again, in a ceteris paribus, comparative dynamic sense, have higher wage shares. This points to the problems I mentioned earlier with the idea of wage-led growth. The first one, and it becomes very clear here, you notice that R is being determined by demand. H is being determined by demand, but additionally by Z, capital outlays. They are both being determined by the same spending, sectoral spending decisions. You cannot then meaningfully speak of causal relationships between the two. You can speak of confounded relationships and pause and look at parameter movements around an equilibrium that can lead to particular associations that you're interested in, but that's a different exercise. And as you act on the world will act unlike what you expect, unless you recognize this. The second point is that if you look at this carefully, you realize, as I said earlier, and this is where the little bit of math will come in, that the role that the consumption behavior of wage earners plays in conditioning the relationship between the real wage and output, which is what the literature is interested in, is actually in some ways the very opposite of what it does in the standard Kaletskian model. And this issue arises fundamentally because workers spend wages that are paid by capitalist enterprises. That dependence cannot be lost sight of, which means that the expenditure of workers fundamentally cannot inject dynamism into accumulation that capitalists themselves cannot inject. The reproduction of the worker is a moment in the reproduction of capital, to put it in more Marxological terms. So I do many exercises. I'd like to do the one that runs most closely to the standard Kaletskian exercise, neo-Kaletskian exercise, which is, what happens if I increase the markup rate? In other words, what happens if I lower the real wage? Yeah? As per the demand equation, two things will happen. One, there is more value to realize. The higher the markup, right, the less costs of production any given level of demand will realize, any given absolute level. You make the Q bigger on the left, the R becomes smaller, all other things being equal on the right, ignoring effects of Q on the right, because I'll get to them in a second. But at the same time, the higher the Q, presumably, the more capital outlays you're going to get, which will ultimately feed into more demand on the right-hand side. So at least on first approach, the net effect is potentially ambiguous. But through a different set of considerations than Marglin, Baduri, and so on. And you can see this by implicitly differentiating that equation. Gives you something very ugly to begin with, but if you limit yourself to considering what you can call, it's an equivalent condition to the Keynesian stability condition, but it's slightly trickier in this setting, makes the denominator positive, and you end up with this particular condition that the derivative of output on the markup rate is a negative measure of the real wage, will be positive whenever this holds. Now I need to explain to you what this is. Obviously, on the left-hand side, I have some measure of the markup, and this is positive for positive Qs and monotonic. Yeah, it's hyperbolic around negative 1 and positive 1 on the horizontal. But it's positive. And the bigger Q is, the bigger this is. On the right-hand side, to introduce some notation, the rows are the share of demand accounted for each type of expenditure. So rho and L is the share of aggregate demand accounted for by demand for non-labor inputs. Rho C is the share of demand accounted for by capitalist consumption, and rho W is the share of aggregate demand accounted for by workers' expenditure. And the etas are elasticities of sectoral elasticities of expenditure in response to changes in R, in income. So what you have here is a weighted average responsiveness of demand to a change in R. Yeah? And a number of things are interesting here. The first thing is, this is the elasticity, the income elasticity, aggregate income elasticity of demand of the worker sector as wages change. And it only appears here, multiplied, obviously, by the elasticity of capital outlays to changes in profits. In other words, the contribution of workers to aggregate demand is inseparable from the outlay behavior of the enterprises that pay their wages. It's the first fundamental difference, and that's the most important fundamental difference that emerges here. So I said this, and the other thing that's interesting is this. You realize that the bigger that sectoral elasticity for the wage earner sector is, the more likely this inequality holds, which is exactly the opposite of what you would expect in the wage-led argument. In other words, the more aggressively workers consume, the more likely it is that an increase in the markup, a fall in the wage rate, in the real wage, not the wage rate, the fall in the real wage, will lead to an increase in output. The more aggressively workers consume, the more likely it is that a higher rate of exploitation will lead to increases in output. That's exactly the opposite of the relationship. People are looking at me incredulously, but the math is there. But you can understand it intuitively. You can ask me later, and I can go into it. I want to get a few things out there before doing
just
this. Yeah, of course.
Your investment function and your consumption function would be most helpful if you told us a little bit about them.
Indeed, because they're slightly different. You're absolutely right. The consumption functions are not that different, actually. The only thing is that I'm positing that there is no fixed consumption propensity. I'm actually not nailing down a consumption function. I'm just saying whatever it is, its elasticity at the aggregate level is what will determine the net effects of these comparative static effects. On the investment function, it's a capital outlay function, which is slightly different because it also includes the payment of wages, and that's where all of the differences come from. So that when an enterprise commences production, it's not just buying investment goods, it's also paying the wage bill. And that's actually at the end of the day where all of the differences ultimately come from. But what's interesting here is that you have a problem, people refer to the problem of realization. If you have a markup, there is a question of will there be sufficient demand to realize that markup at any point in time? And what becomes very clear in this analysis is that actually, whatever you want to call this question, and I'm not sure I like to call it a problem of realization, the issue is entirely posed within the capitalist class. If on the left-hand side markups increase, so that you need more demand to realize a certain level of input costs in current sales, yeah, that is no problem so long as that higher markup is sufficient to entice the capitalists to spend more, either as consumers or as enterprises. Yeah? In that movement, the consumption spending of wage earners is wholly subsidiary. It's a part of the process, but if you have a zero A to ZR, it doesn't matter what your workers are doing, nothing changes. Because the worker spends wages that are paid to him or her by firms. Of course, and the paper does talk about this, household borrowing creates a potential loophole and a wedge in this. But we all know how that went in terms of sustainability of that as a buttress for growth in aggregate demand. I'm going to be very quick because I must be approaching the 20 minutes. I'll skip all of this because this is referring to exercises that I'm not going to undertake here. Blah, blah. Okay. The paper also deals with dynamic issues because, and it took me a while to realize this, and it came from our conversations, and I finally cracked it, which is this. The framework of the circuit of capital is fundamentally dynamic, which means that when you speak of equilibrium, and this I really liked about the discussion this morning, it's actually a little bit trickier. Because what is equilibrium? Is it an equality between commitment to produce today and aggregate demand? And in the structuralist case, that's what equilibrium is. But if you read Taylor very carefully, he's always very deliberate, for example, to say we are assuming production is instantaneous and we are assuming inventories don't accumulate. In other words, what we call total capital in circulation is not a consideration. And Lance Taylor is very aware of that and he's very careful. And that's kind of the point. In conceiving the relationship between supply and demand, in this framework, you have buffers that adjust, stocks. And so what we need to be thinking about is not imposing equilibrium relationship at every point in time, but it is more appropriate to speak of equilibrating tendencies that will arise if the relationship between flows give rise to disproportionate evolutions in stock that will then make the flows behave so as to reduce these back. The extreme case, of course, is the situation in which you posit that outlays seek to maintain target stock flow ratios. In other words, enterprises are seeking to maintain a capacity utilization ratio or an inventory to sales ratio, or workers are only spending so as to maintain a wealth to wage income ratio and so on. If you do that and you assume that you are in an exponential a trend evolution and you stick to those targets all the time, then the determination of distribution that I'm talking about goes away. Because then those variables, those stock flow ratios, targets, pin everything down in the economy. Everything else becomes endogenous to that. So then the real question becomes, or the way to put it is this, the determination of income distribution that I'm raising that leads to this problem with the paradox of cost will have purchase along exponential trends, even along exponential trends, to the extent that you do not have fixed stock flow ratios that regulate the outlays so as to make sure that this is irrelevant. And the evidence, at least from the United States, and as much as there is evidence on these issues, suggests that these series are not stationary. They move. The sales-to-inventory ratio in the United States for the manufacturing and commercial sector has been declining for the past 20-some years, according to a very useful series produced by the U.S. Census Bureau. A colleague who's now at the Levy, used to be at the New School, Michalis Nikiforos, has a paper on the Levy series about capacity utilization and some of the difficulties with the series that the Federal Reserve produces, and he's pointing also to Census Bureau data, again showing, I think, convincingly that there's a good shot that even capacity utilization is not stationary in the long run, and so on and so forth. So the findings of the paper would have purchase. The last thing I want to say to conclude is this, and to wrap it up at the level of the things that matter, actually, because what is enticing about the paradox of cost is the prospect of making what we economists would call a positive argument for goals towards which we are normatively committed, namely higher wage shares. In other words, it's Marx's argument 101. The problem with capitalism is not that it's unfair, it's that it doesn't work very well in its own terms. Right? You're making a positive argument for the kinds of outcomes you want. And the punchline is this, and I have, I guess, 2.5 minutes. If I go into my little overtime allocation, is this policy making in the United States and Britain over the past 25 years, and more recently in a range of middle income economies, have looked to consumption to be the main source of growth in demand. And this has been very, very deliberate and very clear. You just need to read, for example, Alan Greenspan's autobiography, the most poorly timed autobiography in history. It came out in the summer of, it came out late 07, early 08, where he's singing the praises of securitization, high indebtedness, how stable it all is. At least he had the decency of apologizing and saying he was wrong, which is more than can be said for a lot of people. May that as it be. The strategy was very clearly seeking to promote asset price inflation, seeking to facilitate household borrowing, to increase consumption rates at the individual level, and at the macro level, realign economies so that the consumption share of GDP would grow. They succeeded comprehensively on this goal in the United States, where consumption has reached about 70% of GDP. And when I looked at the UK figures, I found that it also took place here. You have almost a 10 GDP point movement as well in the relative measure of consumption over the past 20-some years. And the point is that by this analysis, such shifts, of course, you're dealing with open economies, so things become more complicated, but we would expect, in abstract terms, such shifts in the composition of national income to have, by their own structural virtue, an impact on profit shares, namely increasing profit shares, reducing the turnover time in terms of how much time capital value spends as unfinished goods and how much time it spends as inventories. Increasing profitability, and also increasing profits in relation to wages. So when we're thinking about the paths that we're interested in, that are high growth paths that see, at least over some horizon, rising wage shares, what we need to be thinking about is the unwinding of precisely these processes over the past few years. So that you can have, we can ask the question, what would it take for us to have demand growth be driven most significantly by growth in productive undertakings? Yeah, and that would lead to the kinds of movements we were interested in. What's interested here, and I'll close with this, is the following. That unlike the wage-led versus profit-led dichotomy, we don't end up with a question about distribution of income. We actually end up with a question about the premises upon which society agrees to undertake productive undertakings. Is it left to profit-driven signals that have resulted in the sluggish investment performance that we have seen in the US and Britain over the past 25 years? Or do we recognize that, if you will, the public utility value of aggregate investment and start advocating for that to be factored into the processes through which we collectively as a society decide what to produce? It raises old points familiar to old social democrats and socialists that are a bit broader than simple distribution. I am ready for your questions, I think. Thank you.